Good morning. Go ahead and be seated. Welcome, Council. All right, our first case on calendar this morning is case number 64135, Barrel versus State. Are we ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good. Mr. Becker?
Good morning. Your Honors, may it please the Court, I am Michael Becker, who, along with my associate, Mr. Castillo, are representing the appellant, Dustin Barrel, in this matter. At this time, we would seek to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
And I would, of course, with the permission of the Court, our intention is that I am going to seek to argue the issue relating to failure to swear in the jury veneer, and Mr. Castillo will address the remaining issues.
Okay.
Your Honor, this issue about swearing in the jury panel is a very important and fundamental issue. Before an attorney is admitted to practice law, an attorney is sworn in. Before a judge takes the bench, a judge is sworn in. Before the President of the United States takes office, he is sworn into office. And, Your Honor, it is our contention that this is not a mere formality, that the process of being sworn in indicates a solemn promise to uphold the duty that one is being sworn in to.
Counsel, let me interrupt you at the beginning, just for the purpose of the record. At what point was the veneer sworn in, and did the defense object to the failing to swear at the beginning?
Your Honor, I would say that the jury veneer was never sworn in. As a matter of fact,
I thought after the first one was, my impression was one was called. At some point, there was some discussion that the jury wasn't sworn in, or that the prospective jurors weren't sworn in, and then I thought there was an oath administered. So I guess I'm incorrect.
Your Honor, the lower court judge said that it was not his policy to swear in until we had a petite jury. And yes, he did swear in the petite jury, but he indicated that he doesn't swear in the panel at large. And even when the defense filed a motion for a new trial, the response from the lower court was, that's not how I
do. So did the information seem to say that the jury was sworn in prior to individualized questions being answered, the veneer? Is that correct or incorrect?
That is incorrect, Your Honor.
So they were never sworn until he actually had a jury?
That is correct. And NRS 16.0305 says that the jury shall be, it's not a should be or maybe, it's a shall be, and it represents the legislature's intent that this is a fundamental process of a trial.
Now, when you made your objection, did you bring that statute to his attention and read it verbatim?
I did not read this statute verbatim.
Did you bring the statute to his attention?
Not at that time.
What argument did you make when you made your objection?
Your Honor, I was concerned because the juror was being evasive, and I approached the bench and I said, Your Honor, I'm concerned in essence that the court may have failed to swear in this panel at the inception.
And you didn't set any authority for him to that he was required to swear them in.
That is correct.
You made a general objection.
I did, and that objection was joined actually by the state, who also, in essence, asked the judge to swear in the panel at that time, because I think all parties were concerned at that time that there was an issue of juror evasiveness.
Okay, so I think we've all understand that there was no swearing in of the jury.
So it was a structural harmless.
Your Honor, I would suggest that it was structural.
Why?
Because I think it's fundamental to a fair trial. I think the legislator said that it must be done. And I think that if we don't hold it as fundamental, then there's no way to ensure that judges will continue to swear in jury panels. And if we're not going to swear in the jury panel, what's the point of swearing in witnesses? I mean, there are certain rules that the court should be required to uphold, and this is one of them.
Do you see this commonly in the district courts? I know from our experience, I'm not sure that you do, at least when we were there.
It's not common. In fact, this was a complete aberration. But the jury selection process is so important because counsel has a very limited opportunity to make decisions and to query the juror and to find out information that is essential to determining who can be a fair juror. And if the jurors are not told that they have to be truthful, you're completely undermining the ability of the attorneys to do their job and call out who can be fair in a very limited time period. And we ran into problems here, and that's why it was brought to the attention of the court. And we also believe that the court should have a sua sponte duty to give this instruction. We are contending. It's not like the parties sat silent. It's not like nothing was done. By bringing this to the attention of the court, I don't think that the law requires that you utter the magic word of objection. I think it was clear that the defense was objecting by bringing it to the attention of the court. The state and its responding pleadings say that the defense never did anything to imply that it was objecting. But, of course, by standing up, asking to approach the bench and bring it to the attention of the court, I think it's clearly implied that that is an objection. And in our opening brief at page 15, we talk about the Perotti case where you have the Hobson's choice and the risks associated with antagonizing the judge. Now, this is an early stage. We brought this to the attention of the court. If I do anything more than that, at some point I risk antagonizing the judge throughout the trial process, and that can bring harm to my client. But I would suggest that I did uphold that
responsibility. Don't you always run that risk? That's an easy argument to make, and all we certainly were amenable to objections. And what you say is, this is part of me making my record, not my obligation. I'm not sure how well that argument sits with me. What I would like you to address is People versus Carter, and tell me why that should be distinguished. And I imagine what you're going to say is, in that case, there was a written jury questionnaire that they swore to tell the truth. In this particular case, it sounds to me like counsel went to great lengths, both sides, to tell the jurors they were to understand how important it was that they be truthful and honest in their answers. And so what's really the distinction?
The distinction is...
And this goes to, again, why it should be structural error or not.
The distinction is that things sound a lot different when they come from the bench than they do when they come from counsel. And so when the judge in the black robes tells the jury they must do something, the jurors are far more inclined to do it than when the attorney suggests that they should do something. And I think that ties into some of the other arguments of appellant about comments made from the judge. But when the judge says something, that's far more meaningful than when counsel says it.
Okay.
And, Your Honor, I will certainly avail myself to additional questions. At this time, I would have to defer to my colleague, Mr. Castillo.
All right. Any other questions for him right now? Mr. Castillo?
Thank you very much, Your Honors. May it please the Honorable Court, the two other issues we wanted to bring to the Court's attention was the second issue that we raised. The Court below commenting from the bench about how evidence should be interpreted by the jury. And in this case, the appellant submits that one of the key issues was the credibility of the named victim. And during testimony and cross-examination, one of the issues was what practice meant, because the named victim stated her mother helped her practice what she was going to say in court. And at some point during the proceedings, the court interjected its opinion and stated in sum, "I'm not sure if we could really elicit what practice meant. And sitting up here as a 7-year-old, I would be nervous." And the appellate submits that these comments were an error because the court essentially put its own prestige behind what weight should have been given to the named victim's testimony. And as this Honorable Court is very well aware, in Gordon v. State, and that's cited on page 6 of our reply, this court held that a judge should not comment on the probability or improbability of any evidence, and doing so requires reversal. And we're submitting that in the case of Barr, reversal is required because the jury arguably based their conviction primarily based upon the comments that the court provided regarding the credibility of the named victim.
Counsel, wasn't there some testimony in the record? Wasn't the mother examined as to what she did?
She was as well, Your Honor, and I believe the responded, if you point that out, in their reply with their interpretation of
that. I'm asking you, counsel, what was said, since you argued. I like the whole argument from you, not just part of it.
I understand, Your Honor. I believe the respondent noted that practice was nothing more than telling adults what had happened to her.
So you had the opportunity to ask the mother what she did.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I would submit that ultimately it was up for the jury to decide what practice meant, not for the judge to put his own opinion in.
We understand that.
And the last issue I would ask to bring to Your Honor's attention is that the court below erred by repeatedly disparaging counsel in the presence of the jury. And as this honorable court is very well aware, it's well established that a judge must remain impartial at all times and avoid a controversial manner or tone. And we cited several examples in our moving papers, such as the court saying, "I'll control my courtroom, not you," during a reasonable request for a break, telling counsel to calm down.
Well, isn't there back to that? That was kind of something, it was an O.J. Simpson moment.
Yes.
Because that was done in that particular case where counsel made a statement and said, "Well, we should take a recess," and the court said, "No, I'll control my court," in this particular case, unlike what the judge in that case did. But going back to the previous one, did the court not give an instruction as to they were to basically look at all the facts and look at the law, and not if the court has done anything that goes otherwise, they gave that general instruction?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that instruction was requested by appellant's counsel based on the totality of the comments that were made by the court below. And I respectfully submit that essentially, as my colleague Mr. Becker pointed out, we were faced with a Hobson's choice throughout of deciding whether or not to object or further antagonize the court, and the comments in the totality, as in already the state, basically show that a court repeatedly expressing impatience with counsel does require reversal, and we submit that's the case here. And with that, unless there's any further questions, I'll reserve the balance.
Mr. Casillo, just going back to the portion that your co-counsel argued,
yes,
because
sir,
the transcript I have in front of me has you on the record at the time when that colloquy is given by the court in terms of them not giving the instruction, and they basically asked you, and you basically respond, "That's fine." You don't launch an objection. You don't say, "We would prefer more." And I was a little concerned when I read that.
And I saw that as well, Your Honor, but I believe that we did adequately preserve the objection for the record.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, James.
Okay. Counsel, are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
May it please the Court, Michelle Joby from the Clark County District Attorney's Office for the State. I'm going to limit my arguments to the three issues raised by appellant unless the Court has any additional questions on the remaining five arguments.
I'm very curious as to the question Justice Cherry asked. From your standpoint, counsel has alleged this is structural error.
Your Honor.
In terms of not swearing the jury at the earlier setting. And you as the District Attorney's Office has an obligation to protect the record so if they get a conviction it will stand up. Why was there no objection, real objection by the DA, and is this structural error?
The state's position is it's not structural error. Referring your honors to the pleadings by both parties, there is no case law from any of the jurisdictions cited that say this factor set of circumstances is structural error. Counsel in the appellant's brief did refer to a case in Michigan, but that case is not factually on point. In that case, it was an issue of whether the impaneled or petite jury had been sworn. And in that case, the Michigan court found that that was a structural error because the impaneled jury wasn't sworn to do its duty to follow the law to deliberate. There was no Michigan case law on when the veneer is not sworn. The only jurisdictions cited in the briefs are Alabama and California with People v. Carter. And it's not structural error if you follow the two-fold process of analysis in Carter. The structural error is analyzed in Carter, the Supreme Court of California. They find there's no structural error because there's no proof that a biased jury was, in fact, impaneled. They don't even look at the questionnaire. They don't look at whether or not the jurors signed that questionnaire and what the questionnaire said in doing the first step of their analysis about the structural error. They say no proof of an impaneled juror was biased, and they also say that there's no evidence that a juror actually lied.
But wouldn't the fact that the jurors in the Carter case actually signed the questionnaire indicating that they would honestly listen to the evidence. And, you know, there was an oath there. Here there was nothing.
I agree, Your Honor, but if you look at the Carter decision, the questionnaire and the questionnaire having the language about perjury and under oath was in the second analysis as prejudice. It was not in the first step of the analysis regarding whether or not it was structural error. Obviously, if a biased juror was seated and impaneled on a jury, that is structural error, but that's not what's happened here. There's no proof that that happened here. And so if you look at the Carter court, the court in Carter found there's no structural error, so then they go to prejudice. And in prejudice...
Why did they even need to go to prejudice if they find there was no structural error?
They decided to go to prejudice because it potentially raised the constitutional issue, and so they found there was no objection to that error, to the veneer. Actually, that's not true. In Carter, there was a objection to the veneer before the court continued. There was a motion for a new trial by defense based on the fact that the veneer hadn't been sworn. All of those were denied. And I believe that's why the court went on to the second analysis of whether or not there was, in fact, prejudice, even though there was no structural error. Because it's true, there is error. So there has to be some analysis of that error. It's not structural, so it's not automatic reversal. So then the court in Carter looked at whether or not it was prejudicial to the defendant in that case. And in the analysis of whether or not there was prejudice, the Carter court first notes that the impaneled jury, the jury who made the decision of the guilty verdict, was sworn to do their duty, that it's presumed that they, in fact, did their duty. The court also looked to whether or not it was essentially ameliorated by some of the proceedings in the case.
Tell me exactly when Judge Smith learned that he forgot to swear the jury veneer.
It was after there was an issue with respect to juror number 7. Appellant at that point in time had asked the state to stipulate to excuse juror number 7 for cause. Counsel for the state tried to rehabilitate juror number 7, and after the questions to try to rehabilitate juror number 7 essentially failed, it was submitted the juror was excused for cause. At that point in time, appellant asked to approach the bench, and when they asked to approach the bench, they raised the issue. I don't remember if the veneer has been sworn to tell the oath. And in fact, the judge says, as a matter of practice, for whatever reason, the judge does not. If you look at the record, as Your Honor, Justice Douglas did, with respect to the statements that were made, counsel for the state did, in fact, encourage the court to do the oath. The judge simply did not, as a matter of practice. So counsel for the state tried to encourage that to happen, and as Justice Douglas noted, appellant's response was simply, as Mr. Castillo said on page 134 of the record, that's fine. And shortly thereafter, the court again says we're not going to prosecute for perjury. And Mr. Becker says, okay. Everybody goes and sits back down. And the voir dire process continues.
Why didn't you start over? There was no jeopardy at this point. The jury hadn't been sworn. The petite jury hadn't been sworn. Why didn't you start over? Get another panel up there. The statute's clear. It's a shall.
And
it doesn't say this is a policy of one district court judge. It's wrong.
And the distinction that I would like to draw for the court is that the prosecution cannot ultimately control the judge's decision.
Are prosecutors officers of the court?
They are.
Did that officer violate the statute by not telling the judge you have to swear the veneer?
It was raised and brought to the court's attention
by the prosecutor.
Yes. During that bench conference, Ms. Fleck did in fact tell the court it needs to be done, and the court said, I'm not doing it. So short of substituting the prosecution for the court's going to make its own decision. And I'm not saying there was an error.
Okay, so you're saying there's error.
Yes.
Okay, so we got that out of the way.
Absolutely.
And my question was, why didn't you start over? Why didn't the prosecutor say to the court, let's start over?
The prosecution encouraged the judge to do what he should have done, which is give the oath. And the judge
said, well, it's too late to do the oath because you were on juror number 7 already, right?
Well, we're on the individual questioning, and in fact, there's case law throughout the country that even if the oath is given later, that would remedy the process or remedy the error, that you don't necessarily
have it.
I agree, Your Honor. And that was Judge Smith's decision, and other than the prosecution essentially trying to become the judge and force his hand and force a decision, it was where things were, and so... The issue is whether or not the guilty verdict stands despite this error. And the impaneled jury was sworn to do a duty. There's no evidence they didn't do its duty.
Well, that's not the issue. That's not the issue in the case. The issue in the case is the veneer. We're not talking about the petite jury.
I understand that, Your Honor, as far as the veneer is concerned, as I mentioned in the Carter case,
There was a jury questionnaire in Carter, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
There's no jury questionnaire here.
I don't disagree, and as I articulated before, the jury questionnaire didn't come into the Carter court's analysis when it was talking about structural error. That was nowhere in that structural analysis.
And what state is Carter?
California, Your Honor, which is only persuasive.
Right.
But, counsel, what do we need to do with Peters versus Keefe, Supreme Court case from back in 1972? That was a grand jury proceeding, nonetheless. The court looked at Sixth Amendment right to a trial by jury and the appearance of bias and held that failure to do that created a problem. And they basically, for intents and purposes, were looking at it as structural. Why is it not structural?
And then because it doesn't eviscerate the framework of the trial. There's no proof that a biased juror was sat. There's no evidence that any of the jurors lied. The oath, yes, it is required by NRS statutes. I'm not disagreeing. I would submit to the court that this case is somewhat similar to the court's very recent decision. I'm probably going to get the case name wrong. It's Martin O'Rellin, where the court found that it was a constitutional error, but there was no finding that it was structural. The defense, Justice Sata, which Justice Cherry joined, found that it was structural, but in Martin O'Rellin, where Judge Scan did not bring the jury back in when an alternate was put in its place and tell them to start anew, they looked at the context of the jury's discussions and deliberations, which is much more egregious than when we're talking to the veneer, because there are other things.
The counsel,
that was so egregious, it should have been reversed then. Sata and I were right then, if it's so egregious, is what you're saying.
I'm not saying it's egregious. I'm just distinguishing that this
is. I'm sure you used the word egregious. Did I make it up, or am I hearing things?
No, Your Honor, that is the word I use. I'm just distinguishing it's not a
significant. In fact, you said it was more egregious.
I'm sorry?
You said it was more egregious than this situation.
It went more to the framework of the trial in that case, yes.
More egregious, in other words.
That is the phrase I chose.
Okay.
The selection of a jury in a jury trial is of ultimate importance. And what they're calling into question is whether or not these jurors were selected to be fair and impartial. They weren't under oath. As you said later, they were under oath, but we don't know if they withheld or didn't state during the selection process. So this is a major concern in terms of that right.
And I do appreciate the court's concern. What I would draw the court's attention to is the whole process of voir dire. If it were just an oath, if we only needed them to raise their hands and say, I promise to tell the truth, then essentially we could do voir dire by asking the panel, do you agree to be fair and impartial? And the first 14 who say, yes, I agree to be fair and impartial, can be sat and...
Is that what the statute says, though, what you're saying? Does the statute say that? The statute. Doesn't the statute say you shall swear the veneer?
It does, Your Honor. I'm not disagreeing with the statute, and I'm not saying there was no error.
What are you saying then?
I'm saying that even though there's error, it was not structural error, so it's not automatic.
So when a judge violates the statute, we should just let it go?
No, Your Honor, but I'm saying that overturning the verdict here is not necessarily the appropriate remedy. If there's a concern with how the judge handles his courtroom, there are other avenues by which that can be done. But if you look at the context of the jury, if you look at the impaneled jury, the proceedings, the fact that that jury reached a verdict, the verdict should be upheld, and I submit to you other avenues, concerns that the court has.
What can we do as a court?
Justice Sherry, before she answered, I understand, I appreciate your answer, and you didn't do the action, the court did the action, so it puts you in a strange situation. But the U.S. Supreme Court, in this Peters case, stated these principles of fairness requires not only the absence of actual bias, but also preventing even a possibility of bias, compels the conclusion that a state cannot, consistent with due process, subject a defendant to trial by jury that has been selected in an arbitrary and discriminatory manner in violation of the Constitution and laws of the United States. Illegal and unconstitutional jury selection procedures cast doubt on the integrity of the whole judicial process. They create the appearance of bias in the decision of individual cases, and they increase the risk of actual bias as well. That's language from the United States Supreme Court.
And I apologize, Your Honor, that wasn't something that had been briefed by the parties, so I haven't looked at that.
But that is, that's their verbiage on the bias issue.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. If I may, the state's position is the whole entire process of voir dire. I think juror number 7 is the evidence that the voir dire process, just because someone raises their hand and promises to tell the truth, does not guarantee they're going to tell the truth. Anyone, as Your Honors are aware, sitting on the bench in district court and in your practice as attorneys, in the process of voir dire, in numerous cases, we have jurors who've been sworn to tell the truth, who raise their hand, they promise they're going to do that, and every attorney on both sides can look at certain people in that veneer and say, clearly they're not telling the truth, clearly they're just trying to get out of jury service. And that's just something that we have to deal with, and that's the purpose of the questioning by counsel, which is elicited by juror number 7. Ms. Fleck asks questions, Mr. Becker asks questions. It's those questions, it's the answers, it's the vacillating back and forth, it's the body language, it's those things that...
We understand that, counsel, but we also understand this is a case of allegations of sexual assault on a minor, someone under 14 years old. The jury has to review this. You don't want to have to put a minor, especially a minor that young, through a trial like this twice. The protection of the record, making sure it's done right the first time, is so very important. And as Justice Sherry was asking, the structural error component, it's very troubling.
Can I ask you this? When you had the bench conference, you were all present at the bench conference. Was his, the judge's specific indication was, in this particular case, he chose not to administer the oath, or it was his practice that he never administered the oath to the prospective jurors in the voir dire panel?
It's his practice, Your Honor. It's not just limited to this case.
Did you check it out to see if it is? Have you looked at some of his other cases? Did anybody? You've got investigators. You've got 600 employees in the district attorney's office. Did somebody check it out to see if he was telling the truth?
I talked to other attorneys who have done trials in front of him, and he is consistent in not swearing the veneer.
And no one's ever raised it till Mr. Becker came along?
No, Your Honor. It's been raised multiple times. It just hasn't gotten to this level, is my understanding. I've been... through my own investigation and speaking with other attorneys in the office, there have been numerous conversations about how do we handle this issue. And there have been numerous bench conferences during trials about the fact that the oath has to tell the truth has not been given to the veneer. This is, for whatever reason, the case.
Has anybody gone to Chief Judge former Chief Judge Tagliati or Chief Judge Barker to say you've got a district court judge that's not abiding by the statute?
I have not investigated that, Your Honor. If Your Honors don't have any more questions on that issue, I would just would like to move on. Well, I'm out of time.
Would you give an additional 2 minutes?
Yes, we kind of peppered you with a lot of questions. Let's give you an additional 2 minutes.
I'll
offer that to counsel as well.
As far as issues 2 and 3 are concerned, I think the most important thing when considering these arguments is to look at the context of the statements, look at the entire context of the issues on the record.
So we start off by the judge violated the statute. Let's start with that, and then he disparages the defense attorney. So now what do we say about looking at the whole process?
I submit that disparagement was equal opportunity. And during the voir dire process, if you read the entire process, there's a point in time where the state asked to approach and was equally told, we're wasting the jury's time, make it quick, we're not going to keep doing this. So it wasn't just as a defense, it wasn't just as to the state.
It's okay to disparage both sides and violate the judicial temperament rules.
The judge is responsible for timeliness and monitoring the court's time. He never actually denied a bench conference. We approached, there were other times where, for instance, Mr. Becker asked for the court's indulgence, and the court said, take your time, not a problem. So if you look at the record as a whole, the state's position is there was no disparagement of defense counsel. If you look at the specific arguments made by...
Wait, I just thought you said it was even-handed disparagement. Now you're saying there was no disparagement.
It's even-handed statements along those lines of that tone. I'm not saying it's disparagement. I'm just saying it's not as to one party or the other, where the case law cited by counsel for both sides is that the court was very specific as against the defense, or very specific, disparaging, chastising, criticizing the defense theory, criticizing the defendant's arguments, those kinds of things. That did not happen in this case. There was no chastising. There was no taking issue with the theories of the case or what counsel was doing as far as the substance of the case is concerned. During voir dire, the judge wanted to make sure we were very clear as to watching our time and not wasting our time with the jury, and that's what those comments reflect.
Thank you for your argument, counsel.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Well, Mr. Becker, you can start off by saying, were you disparaged by Judge Smith?
Your Honor, I thought that I was disparaged because at one point in time, the judge had commented also on an opinion from an expert, and I asked to strike the judge's statements as editorial, and the judge, you know, got very stern with me and said, this is my courtroom and you will not tell me what I can and can't say. The general tone of the court towards defense counsel throughout the proceeding was replete with some with a high degree of disdain towards counsel, and we felt very, very trepidatious at times in terms of how we interacted with the judge, because the judge was very hostile to actions taken by the defense at various times to try to represent our client competently.
During any of this alleged disparagement, did you ever think about moving for mistrial? Did you move for any mistrials?
I did not move for a mistrial.
Mm-hmm. What was your strategy there?
Well, I thought at that point, by moving for a mistrial, it would only make things worse, and I did not think the court would grant a mistrial, and I was trying at that time to try to make peace with the court in hope that at some point in time we could tone things down a bit and get to the business of trying our case without having to be so worried and concerned about angering the judicial officer.
Had you been before Judge Smith before?
Yes.
Had you ever had this problem before?
Yes, we have. Your Honor, with regard to the issue on the jury, the swearing in of the panel, at one point during the discourse, I said I was bringing this to the attention of the court for what it's worth, and that was my quote, for what it's worth. The Supreme Court, and there's language that's been quoted from the bench about what the Supreme Court has said about what this is worth and the importance and significance of this process. The Michigan court has said that this was very important and has upheld that that it warrants reversal where you forget to or neglect to swear in the jury veneer, or the petite jury. And the Alabama court has said the same thing. We believe that the California case is distinguished because the California jury was admonished by way of a written jury questionnaire, and that was not done. We think that the answer to the question, was this worth, is something that this Nevada Supreme Court will decide. And we are asking this Nevada Supreme Court to say that this is worth a lot, and we believe that the best way for the Supreme Court to state that is to find that this is structural error and to find that it goes so much to the heart of the process that it warrants a reversal of the jury's verdict in this case. And I will submit to any further questioning. Otherwise, we will submit based on the record.
Any other questions?
No.
All right. Counsel, thank both of you for your fine arguments. Very interesting issue that we've got before us, and so I think we've got our work cut out for us as well. So thank you. We'll move on to the next case. This case will stand submitted.